Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman, a senior lecturer at the American University School of International Service. Thank you all for listening today. I'll be talking to Andrea Graziosi and Frank Sisson about their edited volume, Genocide, The Power and Problems of a Concept, published by McGill-Queens University in January of this year. Andrea and Frank, welcome to the show.
Welcome to you, and that is, I'm very happy to be here with you. So,
and thank you, and we're pleased to do this.
Yeah, thank you. And can you start us off by telling our listeners a bit about yourselves?
Yes, I am a professor of contemporary history. It is modern history in English would be, but in Italy it's contemporary history at the University of Naples in Italy. I've been a specialist of Soviet, Russian, Ukrainian history for the most largest part of my life. I'm almost 70, so it's a long life already. And of course, I came to research or to face the problems of genocide through Soviet history, basically in the 1930s, specifically. So I came to the field through a special door, but then I tried to look beyond that. Thank you.
And I'm a professor of history at the University of Alberta and director of the Peter Jacek Center for Ukrainian Historical Research. I primarily am an early modernist in my work as a historian. And I come to this field of genocide studies in, I think, a certain way that is more personal. I grew up in a Slavic neighborhood in New Jersey where there were many people who were Ukrainians who were survivors of the Holodomor or who were deeply interested in this topic. And also next to the Silk City of New Jersey, Paterson, the town with large numbers of Armenians and Assyrians. And so I as a teenager, through Armenian friends, saw their very different perspective. I was struck when I was at Princeton as an undergraduate how little was said by any of my professors about the famine in the Soviet Union. And at that time point, we were mere 20 miles away from the large monument that the Ukrainian community had put up in Bound Book, New Jersey. As I say, I went on in early modern history, and so I come from a perspective of seeing the religious wars and the massacres, such as in the case of the Khmelnytsky revolt of many Jews, as acts that occur before the modern period of genocide. And then I wound up at Harvard as a first as a graduate student and then as a junior professor at the point when the Big Famine Project was on at Harvard that resulted in Robert Conquest's book. I might add, I also learned very early that genocide studies was a very contentious field. When the state of Massachusetts had a genocide day that included the Holocaust and the Armenian genocide, and when they wanted to add the Cambodian genocide, and then others wanted to join, they decided three was enough. You could see the political battle for genocides. And I also was at Harvard when the UN delegation of the Ukrainian Republic came to threaten the people at Harvard since the Soviet Union still denied it. So all of that led up to the period of independent Ukraine and the great changes. And I eventually, of course, wound up in Canada and am very active with the Holdemore Research and Education Consortium.
Thanks, Frank and Andrea. We'll get into the volume a bit, and I have questions about how it came together. But Frank, you said something there about the contentious nature of genocide studies. And I was wondering if one or both of you could talk a little bit about why is the field so contentious, which, of course, your book grapples with as well.
I don't know. I can go first, but already Frank said this. It is contentious for a variety of reasons. And the most important one maybe is because since the United Nations Convention and the legal definition of genocide that, as you know, carries a lot of weight, political, economic, moral, and gives importance to a people, to a cause, to a people, whatever you mean by it, and a political cause, a nation, an effort at nation building, an effort at liberation from oppression. And all of this is greatly helped by the recognition that in your past there is genocide. So that genocide is extremely contentious, also because on the other end, of course, all the people and the states and the power that are accused of committing one refuse this. And this introduces us to the fact that even, I would start to say this, but then we will elaborate on this later. I think anyway, even if you, as I am, are convinced that the genocide category as it is, the legal one, I mean, the official legal one, creates a lot of problem, you cannot, how to say, circumvent or escape it, and you have to deal with it because it is what mobilizes people, it is what gives importance to the debate, it what feeds conflicts all the time. And it is because it's the reason why states invest a lot on this political legitimation, political opposition to this legitimation. So I think we cannot escape that by now, I don't know, things in history change, but by now and for the last 20, 30 years, because before the situation was different, genocide has become inescapably tied to political issues and conflicts and ideology. And this you cannot escape this. It is like this.
And maybe what I would add is I think we often, as scholars, are uncomfortable with what might be called the messiness of the field and the lack of exactness and the contentions that occur over whether a given event will be called a genocide or not. But I think looking at the other way, one can say that even the discussion on genocide and even sometimes the politically oriented and very controversial battles that go on over whether a given event is a genocide or not, still in a certain way opens up larger numbers of people and scholars to study these events, whatever their final decision may be made on them, and to turn to many topics of human rights, even those who would say that genocide is used too broadly and want to define it more closely, or those who feel that genocide causes us to ignore other categories, I think have to admit that the very genocide convention and then the discussions over it have made many societies more open to discussion of all kinds of other human rights and crimes against humanity.
Thank you. Thanks, Frank. Thanks, you, Andrea. We'll take a step back now and get to the volume and how it came together. And so I'm working on a second volume now that I hope will be complementary to your own. And I find editing a volume to be such an interesting experience, receiving, reviewing, and returning drafts, seeing how contributions progress and evolve, and so on. Doing so also makes me curious about how other volumes come together. In your books, and I, you know, this will be my second edited volume, and I've never co-edited a volume, so I may add a question in there about how the two of you came to know each other and work together. So we'll keep that in the back of our mind for the moment. So in your book's acknowledgement, you note that the volume includes essays presented at a University of Toronto-hosted conference from 2018. Can you tell our listeners more about how the volume did come together, how the two of you ended up working together on it, how you selected the essays, this is many questions, and whether the end product took shape in ways you anticipated when you first decided to bring a collection of essays from the conference together?
So maybe I'll start because it first involves the formation of the Whole of the More Research and Education Consortium. This is a project of the University of Alberta that is funded by the Temerté Foundation, one of the major foundations in Canada that deals with, among other topics, with Ukrainian studies. And I put forth a proposal to that foundation in 2012 to say that both in terms of research and education, there had to be a stable program center that would carry on these activities. And fortunately, that program has been funded as a project of the University of Alberta since that time. Now, what it's meant is that we had the resources to think more broadly. The Holodomor in particular was a very contentious issue, as you know, and we'll go back to. It was denied by the Soviet Union that there had been any famine in the Soviet Union until the very end of the 1980s. And the Ukrainian aspect, or the degree in which it was aimed against Ukrainians, continues to be a point to be debated and discussed. So our goal was then to say, well, how can we then deal with the Holodomor, but put it in some broader context? And our first conference, I believe in 2013, was called Contextualizing the Holodomor. Its goal was to say, what has study of the Holodomor that's occurred since Conquest book brought to a number of fields, Soviet history, genocide studies, general other topics. And at that point, I had to find a specialist who could guide this. And I had the great fortune that Andrea had been working on both the Soviet peasantry, but then later with the specific issue of the famine and the distinguishing of the Holodomor, a relatively new term as it gets called for the Ukrainian famine. And he has been, I will say publicly, our guiding light in this. That is a specialist in the field. I don't pretend to be such. I have worked on some aspects of it, and particularly on the issue of relationship of communities and research on it. And we've done a number of conferences since then, one on communism and hunger, which allowed us to also deal with China and Kazakhstan, one on starvation and hunger, where we could go back and work on Ireland, one on colonialism, empire, and famine, held in two parts, one in Ukraine and one in the West. And then finally, we made the decision that it was time to take on the broader topic of genocide. For that, we were fortunate that Andrea had a longer term interest in that topic. And maybe I'll let him talk a little bit more about how we conceived of that conference.
Yes, but first of all, thank Frank for the good words, of course, appreciate it, but they are not so true. That is partially true, I hope, but not totally. The consortium did a lot, and you did a lot. The problem is that, as maybe I said it briefly at the beginning, but I entered the field as a Soviet historian, basically, as an historian of the construction of the Soviet state, of the Soviet social and economic system. And so it was not my intention to study the genocides at the beginning. And parts to Lushan's, through case, and part to, because it was there, I came through already in the 1980s relevant new documents on the famines, in the plural, that happened in the Soviet Union in the early 30s. because there were other in the early 20s and then after and during World War II. But I specialized especially in the early 30s one. And clearly, when I got this growing feeling, and then at the beginning, about 20 years ago, the certainty, personal, at least for me, that we were dealing not with a Soviet famine. We were dealing with a general Soviet famine, for sure, but with a period of suffering, of problems, of food problems everywhere. But within this, in this context, there were at least a number, five, six even, of specific famines, some of them willed by the regime for one reason or the other, different also in their cause and their consequences. And of course, the largest one was the Ukrainian, upon which I happened to found some interesting documents in the archives, first in Italy, then also in the Soviet Union. And to me, of course, this raised huge problem, problems also to me personally as a historian. That is because I didn't enter the Soviet field to study genocide, of course. But it was clear that when you have, let's say, in the Ukrainian case, 4 million people approximately died in few months, in 5 months of starvation, or in the Kazakh case, about 1.5 million in a, out of a population much smaller than the Ukrainian one, a couple of years before, in 1931-32. Clearly, these events were huge, and they were not studied at all. They were not denied. So the problem started to really became not an obsession, but really raised huge scientific, interesting, but also moral, personal problems to me. And I started to, of course, to look at the literature on genocide and to confront the literature on genocide and the authors. I started to befriend some of them. And to me, it was clear that in order to understand this, we needed to compare. And I was very fortunate. Franz says he was fortunate, but I was very fortunate to meet Frank and this wreck, the Holodomor Center in Toronto and Alberta. And we started to organize these conferences, at first comparing specific cases, then enlarging our horizon. And at the end, we decided to tackle with the category itself, because clearly the category was crucial. Also because, as Frank says, I agree with what he said. Of course, we work together, so we often agree, not all the time, but often. But clearly, genocide is a contentious, it's a, from certain point of view, weak, imprecise category. On the other hand, it's an extremely powerful and also rich and also enriching category, because it forces you to look at things that before you didn't look with attention and you didn't put together. So clearly, from this point of view, it's a real scientific category in the good sense of the word, because it makes you discover things, put together things, and then, of course, go beyond maybe its initial meaning. And I think we started this conference and this volume, out of which the volume came in, precisely because of this, because we wanted to deal with the category itself, respecting it, but without denying the limits. And I just thought one thing that I will return to if there is time later, because I don't believe we, you know, genocide, as I said, is a category one can criticize. Another one that I like to compare is totalitarianism, which is another category that has many problems. I'm not happy with it either, in a way. But they are two categories you cannot do without. And you cannot think of replacing them because of their weight, their historical, political, moral, mobilizing also weight, because they mobilize people. And so the idea was not to produce yet another attempt with this conference and the book to say, hey, we have a better definition. No, this was never our aim. The aim was to discuss, to accept the category, to discuss it critically, and to try to see how can we can enrich other scholars' view of this category. This was the aim of the volume and the conference and the volume, for me at least.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you, Andrea. Andrea, because you started to talk a little bit about what's in your chapter, I want to just keep us here for a moment. Can you talk about where state building and ideology comes into the famines you discuss in your chapter, and then Frank or both of you, if you want to expand that to the broader role of state building and ideology in historical cases of genocide?
Yeah, of course. You know, there is a paradox in a way, because if you read the genocide definition, the legal one, the United Nations one, is a very large one, extremely large. Actually, you can fit in it so many things. Then for about 40 years, until the 1980s, basically, the genocide was the Holocaust, the Shoah. Of course, the Armenians were saying we have a genocide at the end. But the first actually comparative effort were between the Holocaust and the Armenian genocide, if you think of Robert Melson, for example. And already there, you could see that the basis for comparison were the idea that this genocide as a tool for eliminating categories that revolutionaries of different background, ideas, project, with different projects. These revolutionaries had this idea that some categories of people did not belong in their project and had to be done with in some way or the other. So from the very beginning, I think, from the very beginning of the comparative effort, the ideological transformative project, revolutionary vanguard business was there. To me, this came later because, as I told you, I started to find the first documents about this in the late 80s, 1980s. And clearly, but at that point, they were not Soviet documents. So they were always documents from people, from witnesses, in this case, diplomats, in my case, at the beginning. And, you know, with witness, you are able to paint a truthful, more or less, picture, but you don't know how the picture came about. That is, witness can tell you people were dying there, they were dying there, they were dying these months in this region, they were dying this way, but they don't know, they cannot tell you why this process that was killing these people, were starving these people, started. For this, you need the documents from the perpetrators, let's say. And this didn't come until the opening of the Soviet archives, the partial opening of the former Soviet archives. So, but since already with these witnesses, it was clear that you had this huge period of suffering because of hunger, let's say, throughout the Soviet Union, but this was specific focus in Central Asia and in Ukraine. These two were very clear since the very beginning, and they were confirmed later. And also that the two things were different because, for example, one was caused by the requisition, the seizing of herds, of animals, in order to get the meat to provide meat rations to the cities of the north, to the Russian Slavic cities of the north. In the other, it was a problem of wheat, of taking the wheat, the corn, the bread from the peasants, and also to teach the peasants a lesson. This, I'm repeating the word the Bolshevik used then. So the puzzle started to come together, and then you discovered there was another special famine in the Volga German region, for example, in the Volga German Republic, another one in the Cossacks area along the Don. And there was one tied to the deportation of the Kulak at the beginning of the decade in 1930-31. So you started to see that this general time of troubles, of starvation, was there. And people were still fighting, was there a famine in the Soviet Union or not? And you started to realize that there were actually many famines with different mechanisms, different aim, and some of them very political. in a very different way too. I'm insisting, since you ask with Ukrainian and Kazakh, because they are the two most extreme. But I'm sure that the Volga German case would bring a lot of interesting ideas and perspective too. But for example, the Kazakh famine was a colonial famine of the most simple variety. The state needed meat for the city, for the army, for the rations, for state functionaries. They took the meat from the Kazakh. The Kazakh died. Nobody cared. Was not intentional. It's not they didn't want to kill the Kazakh. The Kazakhs were expendable. With the Ukrainian had put up resistance against collectivization, the Ukrainian peasants. They were suspect of, and we know this from these very days, that there were problems with turning Ukrainian into normal Soviet Russian / people. So Ukrainian were not only the state needed the grain, this was there too, but also they needed to break the bones, the spine of the Ukrainian peasantry and also of the Ukrainian communist elite that was then ruling the republic. And so there you had another kind of political targeting and aiming and concept of the use of hunger, if you want. So hunger could be used differently. And so, and I will stop because it's too long, it's very interesting. But so you started to realize that genocide can take place also through starvation, which of course is obvious, but was not so clear to me because when I went to read the literature, there was almost nothing. The Armenian had something on it. And that it can happen because of different reasons, of different intent, of different targets that the state had, or the state, I mean, the state means the political leadership. And from there, of course, I really felt the necessity, the need to confront other scholars studying different other cases, because mine was so different and so variegated and differentiated also. And this is why I really insisted with Frank and the center to have these comparative conferences, large conferences. And the first question, we tried to invite all the meaningful people doing meaningful research. Of course, we were not completely successful, but I am pretty satisfied. And also, I think Frank is with the result. Of course, we didn't get all the papers we wanted to publish. Some we tried very much, but we were not able. Others we insisted we were able. So, but overall, I think it came out as an interesting volume dealing with this difference and the problems, but also that's why this title, it's very important to us, but also the strength, the power of this category.
Thanks, Andrea. Frank, would you like to add anything about the larger role of ideology and state building to genocide?
Yeah, I think very much so. I begin always from the point of an early modernist. And so my first question is this really new? Is this something different that has occurred that is associated with modernity or certain changes in society that occur in the 20th and 21st century? Obviously, those who are strictly legalistic about genocide bring us back to 1948 and say that nothing else can be before that except for what was defined at that time. But I think the other issue is are there changes that occur in the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century that make it possible to say we're dealing with a new phenomenon, a genocidal phenomenon? And you bring up the issue of state building. I think we have to look at it in a number of ways. We have to look at it as empire dissolution and empire reconstitution, particularly if we deal with the Soviet Union. We have to deal with state building projects that go on, but also at the same time, nation building projects that go on that then exclude certain elements out of society. Now, we've tried to deal with it in our conferences in various ways. I pointed out we have a wonderful volume on colonialism, empire, and famine, but that specifically deals with famine all the way from Bengal to Ireland. When we were focusing on this genocide, we had to make, I think, a certain number of decisions as to what would be included, to what degree we would see this as focused on a European Ottoman Empire world of a certain period of the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century that unleashed forces that brought about the genocide activities, and then to what degree they fit with the rather artificial genocide convention, which changes very much Raphael Lemkin's views. I think later when we, in our discussion, one of the matters we bring up in our introduction is that we could have as well tried to deal with colonial societies or European societies coming in contact with indigenous peoples throughout the globe. It would have, I think, led to, as we argue, a very different way of looking at genocide from the convention and from the Lemkin view, but certainly is, I think, one of the topics that we bring up that is also worth exploring. And so in order to do this, as Andrea says, we organized as wide a net for our conference as we could within those understandings. We wanted to deal with both the legal and ethical, but also we, as historians, came from a historical approach in dealing with it. We assembled, I think, an outstanding conference of the days that it occurred, and it was an event that many reacted to extremely positively. And even when there were prevarications or confrontations on views, I think it showed a way of bringing people from various disciplines together and various visions of genocide and dealt well with it. And then we were fortunate in those people who decided that they would be able to give us papers for this volume. And I think we're very pleased with that coverage.
Thank you. It's a great volume, and I'm glad you were able to get the essays that you were, and we'll come back to it in a few minutes, but also the Strauss sort of capstone at the end, I think, really ties it all together very well. So I'm trying to think of the best way where to go next, because a lot of things that I want to talk about have come up in our conversation already, but maybe I'll take us back to the book cover. So taking a few steps backwards, because I do like to ask those I interview about, what input they had on the cover design. And so for our listeners, the cover of Andrea and Frank's book showcases the word genocide, which grows increasingly larger, from tiny at the top of the cover to running off the cover about three-fourths of the way down. A genocide is in a black font with a red background. And below this portion of the cover is the subtitle, The Power and Problems of a Concept, and the name of our guests, of course, as the editors, which is in black font, but on a white background. Is this something the two of you came up with? Is this the publisher's design? And either way, are there connections between the cover design and what's included inside the cover?
Well, I think I think this can be very brief. Actually, we were proposed this, and I went to check to be sure, and we liked it. I think it gave us, it gave a good idea of what we wanted. That is, we wanted to stress the importance of the concept, but also its problems. We only asked them to, use a larger font for the subtitle. I don't think they did, frankly. I am one has to be honest, but they promised they would, but they didn't. But actually, I was very happy, and Frank too. I went to read this email too. The cover looked good, and I still like it very much, which is not usual in the sense. In other books, I had huge fights about covers. I sometimes lost many times. But this one I particularly liked, and judging from Frank's email, he liked it too. So this was not a contentious, and it was not our idea, one has to be frank about it.
I consulted with artistically more adept people at our at our center as well, who all liked it. I would say that we were very pleased with Queens McGill for what they did with this. But I also want to say I am especially pleased with the subtitle, which we did spend some time back and forth on. And I think the power and problems of a concept was exactly where we were going in this volume. It was not an easy definition or terminology to come up with, but I think it does it very well. So we probably wanted it to be a little bit larger, but aesthetically, I think the book is excellent.
Thank you both. I appreciate you humoring my my cover design question. I was actually going to point out, since Andrea mentioned it, The Power and Problems of Concept, the subtitle, is probably about the size of the third or fourth genocide on the cover, which is fairly small. Certainly the subtitle still stands out, especially with the change in color of the cover for that section. On a different note, we're witnessing a healthy increase in reflective and critical thinking about genocide, to which I think your edited volume makes an excellent contribution. And I'm thinking of other books, and I've interviewed Dirk Moses about the problems of genocide as just one example. Where does your volume kind of fit into this critical thinking or critical genocide studies part of the literature?
As I said, first of all, I thank Frank for reminding also me that actually we had a little exchange on the subtitle, and I was very pleased with our success there, that I accepted that the Power and Problems of a Concept, the subtitle. I already, you are right, I touched upon it. I shouldn't have done this, maybe. But the problem is this, that I am not I too, for a time. Again, the parallel with totalitarianism, I think, helps. I thought, you know, this concept, this category doesn't help me. I want to change it. I want to impose a new, better category. And you simply cannot do this, because these are extremely powerful categories. And they have meanings for many people, different meanings. They are very solid. And with totalitarian, with the genocide, there are even legal categories that carry huge impact, you know, on states, on money, on reparations, on legitimation, and so. So we, contrary to other colleagues, and I belong to them. I was like them, so it's not a criticism. In a way, I think I now think it's not correct to try to produce a new category of genocide. What you can do is to enrich the one we have, and you can enrich it by showing that it has different meaning, it covers different contexts, it can use. Think about, for example, the essay by Annette Tim about sex in our volume, or the one about Scott Strauss about Africa and experience. Or the way I started, looking at starvation used in different ways. And by doing this, I think you come up not with a different concept, but certainly you take a distance from the legal definition. You do not try to substitute. And I think this is, by the way, what Liemkin himself ended up with doing at the end. Because this is now more or less well known. Liemkin at the beginning was a Zionist. He was, let's say, in quotation marks, as an essentialist, as they now say. Not now, for many decades now. He believed in ethno-nationalism in a way, like Zionism was this. And then at the end of his life, he looked at people, like at the concept of a people, as something extremely wide and open and elastic in a way. And I think it's the same with genocide. That is, at the beginning, we thought genocide is just when you kill an ethnic people. Even the social was, you know, cut out because of Stalin and the Soviet. But actually Liemkin was able to already in 47 to add a lot of cultural, religious criteria in it, to enrich the concept. But still, it's very rigid in a way, even if it's so large. So by enlarging it, by criticizing it, but by keeping it and by using it, I think you do a better service than trying to produce a new definition. You mentioned Dirk Moses, who I, of course, enormously esteem Dirk. He was actually in Toronto at the conference, and he contributed greatly to the conference. But I don't think that I admire his attempt to give a new meaning to the category, a new interpretation of the category in a way. I don't think maybe he's right, I'm not sure, but it is my impression that you cannot do this. What you can do is to show that this category is so rich and so powerful because it allows you to see what you didn't see before and to put together things that you didn't put together before. At the same time, it's a category that needs constantly to be reassessed. From this point of view, it ends up with being a very good concept. This is what it's now my impression, and also gives you a lot of room for discussion. The only problem is, since it is so mobilizing in a way, it's very difficult to discuss. Even at Toronto, as Frank may remember, maybe you have the same experience, Jeff, I don't know, with conference. When you have a conference on genocide, you have all sorts of militants showing up. So the discussion easily turns into something else, not the scientific discussion only that you would have loved. But this too is another indication of the strength of the concept, I think.
Thanks, Andrea. Frank, do you have anything to add?
Yes, I do. And I will add one more thing to tell the truth of our conferences. All our conferences have been open access except this one, in which we limited it to the university community and some other peoples involved in it, hoping that this would make sure that we would have lively debates and even harsh ones, but they would not go on beyond it. We did have public lectures as well at this conference, which were open to everyone. But this was the first time we tried that, and I think it worked relatively well, although the scholars and university public and other invited guests did manage to, I think, shake it up once in a while. What I would say is, I go back to our power and problems of a concept. We admitted that there are problems, not one problem, and we affirmed the power. And where I see it is when I look at these papers and realize they brought and meant something to me in another way. And what do I mean? Tim's paper was mentioned on the Holocaust. It reminded me of the Armenian elderly ladies of my youth who seemed so withdrawn in life. And of course, in a society in which whatever their experience had been was never going to be discussed. And yet one can read the Holocaust article and see that. Rethinking the various positions of powers. If much of my life I've concentrated on the Soviet Union and its nefarious activities, very good to read Fournier and see quite what the French were facing with Algeria, and it fit in with our other colonialism issues. Or Toussaint's article on Armenian, in which she calls for this longue durée, but what she really means is that genocide as a concept is now passing into the second and third generation. We now have societies of children of Holodomor survivors, as of Holocaust survivors and other groups, and they then become part of a widened genocide. And then, you know, Anton Weiss's article brings us back to the jockeying that goes on. We'll discuss, I think, as well, the article on Lemkin, when one realizes that the situation in which it was hammered out, and as well the life that Lemkin had, and for those of us interested in Ukrainian studies, very interesting, because towards the end of his life, he was basically surrounded by the Ukrainian and Baltic communities who were the most interested in this genocide concept at that time. So, you know, I think the variety of articles and regions covered are never all, obviously they are, we are 9 articles. They are not covering all of the possible places and they don't do all of them in depth, but they all nicely interrelate to each one who's looking at where genocide and study of genocide, I think, may be of use or broaden understandings.
Thank you, Frank. So we talked a little bit about multiple meanings of genocide now, and I was thinking, you know, as a comparative study and certainly an interdisciplinary field, I still wanted to ask a little bit more about these multiple meanings and how, can genocide be applied to different cases where there's different degrees of intent? Can genocide have different meanings historically, politically, legally, sociologically, anthropologically, all areas that contribute to genocide studies? And then a related question, if we do have this interdisciplinarity, which I do think should be celebrated, can this also, along with different meanings, lead to the risk of conceptual stretching, of the term genocide?
So my answer, short answer would be yes, we can have it. We do have it, so it clearly can exist. On the other hand, I think it varies internationally. One of the things that I find out dealing with my German colleagues is there's a great reluctance to move beyond the legal concept of genocide. And that the type of genocide studies that exist in North America are quite alien to German academia. This comes up with the issue of as well, recognitions of genocide. So obviously we have an international community of scholars in which scholars have differing visions of what should be emphasized. But I think we have de facto in North America come to this much broader one. Is it dangerous to go too far? Well, we pose some of these issues of broadening it in our introduction. We said that we did not take on the issue of the contact of European societies with indigenous peoples throughout the world, North and South America, and because this would move away from the specifics of the Lemkin definition and the UN Convention. And yet I work in a Canada in which this is the major issue in which not only my students are interested, but also a broader community that is trying to deal now with the indigenous issue and the issue of whether genocide is appropriately applied to indigenous groups. So I think perforce interested groups will draw us in new ways. Does it show the danger then of becoming too broad? Yes, of course. So we can have subscripts next to the genocide if we wish. It's not what we argued for in our introduction, where we argued for a more limited use then took on Scott Strauss's suggestions as perhaps a way to deal with other such events. I think as long as the discussions are held based on as good research as we can and as honest a discussion, we will find groups who will want to include various events which may or may not be accepted by broader international communities. Where it becomes much trickier is the issue of political recognitions. And as we pointed out, these are extremely important today. Will each of our disciplines work differently? Well, I think both of us started as historians coming to this. Were we anthropologists or sociologists, I think you might find a different volume and particularly a different introduction. And certainly if we were lawyers or legal historians or legal specialists, it might look quite different than what we have.
Yeah, I basically agree with Frank. So we have a multiple, if you want, a concept with multiple meanings, very different. This is clear, so it's not interesting to repeat it. Frank mentioned the colonial use of the term now. It's completely different from the idea that was behind Lemkin, creation of the concept, and also behind the the legal definition, the 1947 United Nations definition, because you have a genocide that spans for centuries, committed by multiple actors in different settings with different ideas. There, it requires intent, an actor, a policy, a specificity. So, and I think this too, it's good because it makes you see different things. I would just add very briefly that still we cannot forget that there is a legal definition. Not, I think that as an historian, I would not use it because historians do create their own concepts to interpret history. But the legal definition is there. It has a huge power because, again, if you're accused of genocide and if you, they can bring you to trial, they can put you in jail, remember Milosevic, they can make you pay a huge amount of money. They can, and if you are an oppressed group that wants to be legitimized, if you're able to say you are the target of genocide, your political power in a way is increased enormously. So I think that we can explore, we can expand, we have to. It's very good that we do this. At the same time, we have always to remember that we are dealing with something that is a very precise definition. It's a very open one, as I said, it's not a closed one. From this point of view, the idea you couldn't compare the Armenian and the Holocaust, looking at the 1947 convention is insane because, of course, there is much more in that. But that definition is there, and I don't think are going to change it because you need another United Nations convention. That would be extremely difficult. So we have also always to remember that we have to live with this legal definition. And that, think of the Ukrainian. When the Ukrainian tried to have a new legitimizing discourse for the new state, and they decided, after some discussion, of course, not a general societal discussion, that Holodomor was a good basis to build a legitimizing discourse. But this was done also because there was an attempt to get the Holodomor recognized genocide by states on the basis of the 1947 definition. And the same is true for everybody else. So I think although there are multiple meanings, we are very right to explore them, but we should never forget that there is also this extremely powerful tool there that people utilize all the time.
Yeah, thank you, Frank and Andrea. What you were saying just made me think of, Leo Cooper, one of the early comparative genocide studies scholars, when he wrote in Genocide, Its Political Use in the 20th Century, quote, "I shall follow the definition of genocide given in the convention. This is not to say that I agree with the definition. However, I do not think it is helpful to create new definitions of genocide when there is an internationally recognized definition and a genocide convention which might become the basis for some effective action, however limited the underlying conception." As you mentioned, Andre, about a new genocide convention would be needed. As we know, the ad hoc tribunals for Rwanda and Yugoslavia and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court both, basically used the genocide definition in the convention identically. So even when there have been subsequent opportunities maybe to amend it slightly, even just for those specific court purposes, they've chosen to go with the definition from the genocide convention.
Yeah, precisely. I think Cooper was perfectly right. I have another fear, I have to say, if I may say something without a question, because this my fear, and I think this comes out of Scott Strauss very well in what is happening in Rwanda, in the sense that this, like all categorizing, because categorizing, of course, you cannot think of genocide without the idea of creating categories of enemies, right? Of targets, of political people or social people or religious people to eliminate, to destroy, to deport, to do whatever, to break, to starve into submission. So there is this categorizing the victim before killing it or getting rid of it or breaking it. And on the other hand, categorizing is bad, and this is the main reason why categorizing is horrible. But also categorizing provides a fixity also in the relations between, let's say, perpetrators and victims and in history. It's like once you have done this, once genocide has happened, this is another, really, I didn't think of it before reading Scott. You start, it's like things are not changing. When there is a victim, it's a victim forever. When there is a perpetrator, like if there are categories that are fixed over time. This is another problem with the Genocide Convention. I think that as historians especially, we should always remember that history changes very fast things, very, very fast. So we should not stick to fixity about anything, especially categories, and especially interpretation. Otherwise, as in Rwanda, genocide can become a tool also of oppression in a way. This to me was new. I know it's very difficult to deal with this, to think of it. To me was it opened my mind to this possibility too. So that's why I think we should think of it. We should never freeze anything, and be open to change, and to change our mind, of course, and interpretation also. This, to me, is very important. That's why I wanted to tell this, because categorizing can be very deadly also to our capacity to see change.
And I think I was pleased, Jeff, when you began saying that Strauss's essay fits so well to finish the volume. Obviously, this mass categorical violence is something that we could pick up in our attempts to deal with how far genocide should go, what other categories could go. But I really do think this discussion of, you know, who's victims can become perpetrators, changing categories is extremely important, and important for all discussions of genocide as well.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you, Frank. With that, I want to close us with an excerpt from your book, which kind of relates to some of the things we were just discussing there. And this is from the introduction to the volume that the two of you wrote. Quote, "The very power of the concept and the focus on establishing what is and is not genocide risks obfuscating everything else, including other instances of violence, and impoverishes the intellectual debate. Scholars and especially historians are thus called to wrestle with the problems raised by the genocide category, as well as, quote, with some of the intended and unintended consequences of the work that the label does," end quote. As you close the introduction to your volume, you endorse Strauss's mass categorical violence. You also mentioned that Dirk Moses presented at 2018, which I am assuming may have been an essay that ultimately ended up in some form or another in his The Problems of Genocide. When considering Strauss's mass categorical violence, were you also considering Dirk's permanent security as a way to describe broader violence, or, you know, how did you come to your decision to endorse mass categorical violence?
To me, of course, Dirk, yes, it's like you said, he was preparing his volume, I think, and so it was very rightly concentrated upon this, and also he contributed so much with the journal, the edits, and so on and so forth. I think that permanent security, it adopts, if you want, a state-centered perspective, as categorizing does from this point of view, even though I would use state in a very large, giving it a very large meaning. An organized group, armed group, can be a proto-state in a way, and can categorize enemies and kill them without having, you know, the legal recognition, the political recognition of being a state. I like Strauss' category, Scott's category, because it fit immediately with my study, because another line of study I conducted before was about ethnic cleansing in Europe, in Central, Eastern, Southern Europe. And there too, you couldn't speak just of genocide, because of course, if they killed a few thousands in order to have a few hundreds of thousands to live. Let's put it, it's horrible, of course. It's not genocide for the 1947 Convention, but it is an horrible act of categorization, of singling out an enemy and getting rid of it, although not maybe killing him, her or whatever. So the idea is that with all these state-building activities that went on, especially but not only in Europe at all, in the 19th, 20th century, all the states' project, not all, most of them, singled out enemy. As Frank said at the very beginning of our conversation, if you want to have a Turkey, you didn't want Armenian or Greeks. If you want to, you know, Italy didn't have a lot of violence, actually very little violence during the Risorgimento, but still we didn't want Germans in Italy. You had categories that didn't belong in the project. And you could deal with them in different ways. And I think from this point of view, a concept like mass categorical violence gives you this idea that there are organized groups that single out enemies because they have project to implement, and these categories are an obstacle to the project, and they have to be eliminated. From this point of view, I like also the fact that if you adopt this perspective, then genocide becomes the extreme, if you want, the most extreme form of this way of reasoning. Because at that point, like the German did with the Jews, you go to sabotage your own war effort in order to go and get the Jews where they are to kill them. Because you want to kill all of them, which is not true with other episodes. So I think that that category I liked because it gave me a key to understand the more general phenomenon, and that on the other hand, it also gave me the possibility to single out very extreme specific instance of the liquidation of an entire group that we could call genocide. This is the reason, at least for me.
And what I might add is, although the introduction is quite broad, general discussion, it was indeed generated by the papers that were going into the volume. Now, that doesn't mean it excluded other ideas as well, but I think within that, Scott's, Strauss's category, I think, spoke to both of us in doing it, as we had to deal with the various problems of the word genocide, not only the concept. I think of this frequently now, as anyone involved in Ukrainian studies, I'm now involved constantly with the discussions of whether the Russian policy now towards Ukraine or Putin's policy is genocidal. And we've had some people speak out very strongly on it, like Francine Hirsch. We do numerous discussions on it. There are certainly genocidal statements that are coming. And you know, now, as we see in the abduction of children and sending them to Russia, there are clearly moments that fall under the genocide convention. It makes me then rethink at times these issues, because then I see it is easy for us to endorse another name, but that name doesn't have the legal or even the obligation, as there is in the Genocide Convention, if genocide is imminent for outside powers to act. So in a certain way, genocide will always hold a primary place as long as it is a defining legal category that involves international relations and all of the other considerations we brought up. I think we still got to go on as historians or as students of genocide and question that category and look for other ways of dealing with it. And this, I think, is a particularly effective way.
Thank you both. And just to wrap us up, you know what you said there, Frank, at the end about the legal obligations associated with Genocide Convention being a part of international law, in some ways brings sort of full circle back to its contentious nature and how it's used or misused. And of course, these debates have been going on in genocide studies for some time. So, you know, thank you both so much for your this great volume and for joining me to discuss it. And as we do, you know, close here, I wanted to see if you, the two of you are working on anything, whether together or individually, that our audience could keep their eye out for in the future.
Frank, you go first or I go first?
You go first, I'll go second. Okay.
Actually, I'm trying because I've been trying for many years because I was so impressed by this story of the use of categories. And the creation and use of categories by political groups in a very broad sense, then I'm trying to write a book on this. The way human beings were categorized and how these categories were born intellectually, even at the beginning, and then politically used, and how. So yes, I'm trying to do this. Of course, it's a crazy project. I don't know if I would ever be able to finish it, but this is what I've been working on for many years now.
And I am redirecting my attention back to the early modern period and trying to deal with the massive revolts in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth of the 17th century, which involved certainly mass violence and social change, and try and work out some of the problems related to Polish, Ukrainian, and Russian history, at least at that basis of the 17th century, which I view is so crucial for the formation of the modern world.
Great. Both sound incredibly interesting. Thank you. And of course, please do keep in touch. I'd be happy to interview both of you again when future work comes out. And thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye, Frank.